A lot changed ahead of this primary election. The pandemic, mail-in voting, a national reckoning on racial justice. And that means campaigns had to adapt too, fast and real time. So what worked and what didn't? And what lessons could political strategists take away from some of the big congressional races this year? Still with us is WBUR political reporter Anthony Brooks. Welcome back, Anthony.
Hey, thanks, Tiziana.
And two additional guests join us for this deep dive into a few of the Democratic primary races in the state and what we can learn from them. First, we have Marcella Garcia. She's an editorial writer for the Boston Globe. Welcome, Marcella.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Scott Ferson, Democratic strategist, president of the Liberty Square Group. He's also a paid consultant on Ed Markey's campaign. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so about two-thirds of the votes this time were supposedly cast before Election Day. We heard that 850,000 number from Secretary Galvin on the 1st. How did that change this election? Marcella, let me have you jump in first.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest takeaways from this election, that it had to be a pandemic to sort of spur this electoral reform that, you know, people for years have been asking, mail-in voting. And it served, I think, as a dry run for making it permanent. I think it was a huge success. You know, the record is going to be broken, likely. Right now, it's more than 1.6 million people casting votes statewide. And I think it shows that when you remove barriers to voting, when you make it easy for people, or easier for people to vote, people vote. When you put a ballot in people's hands, they exercise their right to vote. And I think that's pretty powerful. It's a pretty powerful statement. And I think it makes it's so much more compelling to pursue further electoral reforms like same day voting registration, or making it a holiday, you know, voting day, or moving it to a weekend. What's interesting to me is that, you know, we saw this huge turnout because there was a contested Senate race. And it was because Joe Kennedy decided to challenge Senator Markey. And I think that's obviously what drove the turnout. But the pandemic definitely showed, you know, it's sort of a silver lining, right? That we can do this, that we can do mail-in voting in a safe, relatively easy and calm way. I did not see major disruptions or problems. And I think that shows why we need to make it permanent.
So let me ask about that, Scott. Marcella just said that's why we need to make it permanent. Do you think it will be?
Well, I think it's less scary now. I mean, our elected officials make the election laws. And I think there's a certain amount of unease with change because they were elected under the present rules. And then when you say we're going to open it up, I'm sure there's a lot of skepticism of what that exactly means. And it wasn't scary at all. In fact, you know, there was a pretty good mandate for incumbents here so I agree with Marcella that it worked. You know, it could have been complicated. It could have been hard for cities and towns to process it, but it wasn't. And the vote came in fairly efficiently. And we're even seeing that play out in the 4th in a very, very tight race. I think the other thing that makes it a success, and I didn't think about it actually until one of my interns, who's a college student, mentioned it to me in a race that they were working with for a governor's council race with a first time candidate who got 70,000 votes, is that they heard a lot of people who said, I got my ballot and I sat down at the kitchen table and I Googled all the names. And normally in voting, you have to kind of do your research first, and you come in with a little slip of paper, you try to remember. And if you see a down ballot race and you don't know who they are, you skip it. And here, I think people spent more time with their ballots. And that's actually an excellent way for democracy to flourish and be in form an electorate. And so I think for those two reasons, it will be permanent.
And Anthony, in your reporting and talking to voters, is there a hunger for that, this scale of mail-in voting from here on out?
You know, I'm not sure that I had an opportunity to really put that question to a lot of voters, but I think I agree with a lot of what's been said. I mean, we should also point out that mail-in voting has been used. I mean, Massachusetts was relatively slow to this game. There were Western states, and by the way, predominantly red states, that have been doing it for years. So this idea that mail-in voting is some, you know, dangerous threat to democracy and inviting fraud that's coming from the White House, for example, this is a relatively recent notion. You know, critics see it as a pretty obvious play toward voter suppression. But You know, the one thing I would say is that, or I guess I'd say two things about last night. It seemed to go incredibly smoothly, but we do have a very close race in the Massachusetts 4th in the Democratic primary there. And I'm reading that the Secretary of the Commonwealth, William Galvin, is asking a court to authorize local election officials to continue counting state primary ballots that were received on time but had not been tallied as of the end of last night. And that's due to the volume of the mail-in ballots. And it's also due to the fact that existing state law lacks procedures, I'm understanding, for counting of state primary ballots after Election Day. It's worth bringing that up because you could just imagine if in Massachusetts we're facing this moment and it could have consequences on the counting of ballots in the 4th Congressional District, imagine if this is happening on a big scale after November 3rd, and you've got White House lawyers demanding recounts and doing all kinds of stuff around mail-in ballots in battleground states where, you know, upon which might hang the outcome of the election. That's the only thing that scares me. It's not a knock against mail-in voting. It's just like it's uncharted territory. And in this time of huge political division, it does worry me.
And just to illustrate that for listeners, the top two vote getters so far in the fourth, Jesse Mermel and Jake Auchincloss, in reports, just a couple of hours ago, they were about 500 votes apart with not all the votes in yet. So we are talking close. I want to talk campaign strategy here. Let's look at the Markey and Kennedy campaigns. And what I'd like to do with the three of you is a free for all. So please jump in, talk to each other back and forth. We're on a little bit of a sound delay because we're in three different places. But I want to hear from all of you about the good, the bad, and the ugly of campaign strategy in these two campaigns. Jump on in.
You mean
or
just,
Marcella?
Yeah, go
you
ahead.
Can go first.
Marcella, you go first, Marcella.
All right, the good. I think the good is, again, I think it's always good to have a raise. A lot of people resented the fact that Joe Kennedy decided to go after Senator Ed Markey. But I think at the end of the day, you want to test, to challenge, you know, your elected officials. And in this case, Senator Markey more than rose to the challenge. And to his immense credit, he decided that he wanted to stay a senator and he went out and fought for it. So I think that was a good outcome. You know, everyone, I think, gained from this process. You know, we had a record turnout. That would not have happened if there hadn't been a statewide race. So I think that's one good. The bad, I think, you know, it's not bad or ugly. It's just like this whole chatter about ranked choice voting is very confusing in the context of the fourth congressional race. Obviously, we need ranked choice voting. There's no question. We need it before this race. We need it after. But the way some observers are using the fourth as an example, yes, you definitely, in a wide open race with nine or more candidates, ranked choice voting is the most effective way to, you know, to get at what people really want, most people in the district really want. So, but if ranked choice voting is in place, campaigns are run different, races are run differently. So I think it's misguided, I think, not bad or ugly, but it's misguided to apply this lesson of, oh, if we had had ranked choice voting in the fourth, so-and-so would have won, because that's not how, I don't think that's how it would have worked.
The idea, Marcella, being that there were a whole bunch of progressives who kind of occupied the same lane and they may have forced each other kind of out.
Correct. But even within the progressives, there were shades of progressiveness. There were shades of Democrats, right? So everyone sort of lumped together the progressives against Jake. But even within the progressives, like, you know, maybe saying Leckie vote, you know, maybe a second vote. It's not guaranteed that the second vote of a Lysaine Leckie vote would have gone to Mermel or Linos. You know, you just don't know. People rank their choices in a very different way. You know, some might go by policy, some might go by likability. And this is why when you have ranked choice voting, campaigns are run differently. You know, people are not as negative. It's just the whole dynamic changes. So I think it's a good lesson, but let's not overthink it.
And just to note for voters, that is a ballot item in November. Ranked choice voting is here in Massachusetts. Scott and Anthony, let me give you a chance to react, build off of there. Tell us a little bit more about campaign strategies that were effective this year.
I'd like to focus on the good as well, because I think there was a lot of good. And we've talked a little bit about the, you know, the mail-in voting. I think in the Markey Kennedy race, first of all, I think they end the race both with very high favorability ratings. Voters, and I see this in polling, like them both, even though the focus was sort of on the contention between the camps. So they think highly of them, and I think generally do for elected officials on the statewide ballot in Massachusetts. But I think I like democracy. And so even though I was working for Senator Markey, I like the fact that that democracy was exercised and there was a challenge. I worked for Senator Kennedy in 1994, and I think he was a more attentive senator after 94, cemented his legacy in the 15 years from 94 until his death, and made him the line of the Senate. And I think Markey, particularly if the Democrats take the Senate and Biden is elected, is poised, even though he doesn't have seniority in the Senate, but it becomes a very, very powerful senator in terms of the things that he articulated in what I thought was an excellent victory speech last night. And I think we'll see a different Ed Markey. The other thing I think, too, and John Walsh, who gets a lot of credit, I think, for the win last night, the campaign manager, said early on, I think people at the end of this will say, I didn't know that about Ed Markey. And I think now voters in Massachusetts have a broad appreciation for the depth of his legislative accomplishments and what he's done over his tenure. And quickly on the fourth, I look at the results, and everyone's focusing on the top two, but I just want to point out that if you add the votes that women got in that district, it's overwhelming. So this sense that this misnomer that you can't have two women in a race because one will take votes away from the other, hopefully now should be put to bed completely, because that's not the case at all. And it hasn't been. I worked on Eileen Dunne's campaign again with Nikki Tsongas. Two women combined in that race 15 years ago got 65 or 70% of the vote. So I think people are thinking in a much more modern way about this, and not in gender politics, which I think is a plus as well.
Well, that is.
And by the way, may I jump in really quickly to say something about that? Dr. Natalia Linos performed extremely well for someone who jumped in the race only a few months ago. I think, we need to, she may be, a rising star, because I think that her campaign impressed a lot of people. She was very thoughtful, epidemiologist, obviously running at the right moment, but she got in too late. I think if she had gotten in earlier, she would have given, a real fight.
Anthony.
I was going to jump in and say, I'm always interested in terms of the positives, in what ways political campaigns improve or change or alter people who are public servants, essentially. And a couple of times I asked Markey this. I asked him this morning. I mean, in what way did this hard-fought campaign change him? And his answer basically said, I wish I had the tape for you to play, but basically he said it helped him become more attuned to this moment, this debate, this moment of movement for racial justice and so forth. His alliance with District Attorney Rachel Rollins, for example, he cited that. So when you have a hard-fought campaign like this, I think it does potentially allow folks, even people like Markey, who have been serving forever in Washington, to sort of revisit themselves and the purpose for which they are going to Washington to represent the people, and really think anew about why they're doing this. And I'd like to take him at his word that, he's thinking in new ways about this moment around racial equality across the nation. So I think that's a positive. In terms of the negatives, go ahead, Scott. I'd love to know.
I agree with you. You could see that galvanize him as it went on. I mean, the last 6 days of the campaign, all he talked about was racial and economic equality. And so he really, I think you could see it just in his whole thinking in terms of what the underlying key was to all the policy decisions and things that he'd worked on over the years.
There's another detail I just want to throw in here, because Scott mentioned John Walsh, who is Markey's campaign manager, a terrific talent in the world of sort of political organizing. He organized Deval Patrick's first successful gubernatorial campaign. And I asked John Walsh a year ago when Kennedy got in this race, and I'll admit that I was coming at him with a little bit of a challenge. It's like, holy crap, dude, you know, Joe Kennedy is challenging your guy. I mean, this guy is young, he's handsome. I mean, you know, what are Kennedy's faults, and how are you going to go defend Markey? And Walsh looked at me and said, Joe Kennedy has no weaknesses. He's young, he's handsome, he's rich, he's a Kennedy, and he's a nice guy. You know what his problem is in this election is going to be? He's not Ed Markey. And I thought it was sort of a great answer because it kind of, first of all, he gave me that answer without even hesitating. But he had a lot of confidence that his guy could rise to the moment and that his job was just to ensure that voters really got to know Ed Markey. And that was Markey's big deficit going into this race. Was polls showed that a lot of people didn't know who he was, in spite of the fact that he'd served so many years. And I think what Markey managed to do in the course of this campaign was convince, well, obviously he did it, to convince enough people who he was. And that's one of the reasons he won.
And you know, I was just going to jump in. That the results also show him where weaknesses are for him. Absolutely, I agree that this campaign gave him an opportunity to say, this is who I am, this is what I stand for, and this is what I will do. But if you look at the results, Kennedy won in most of the gateway cities, in places where, you know, Lynn, Chelsea, Lowell, Lawrence, places where you have a lot of poverty, where you have a lot of immigrants, where you have a lot of pain right now because of the coronavirus pandemic and the economic struggles that brought. So I think there's a lesson there for him too, right? That, you know, maybe he needs to pay attention. And I'm not saying he hasn't paid attention because he's been a leader in some of, on immigration, for instance. He has led on so many immigration policy issues, but I'd be curious as to how he approaches these places going forward.
And I think this is his job now.
Exactly.
You know, he spoke about racial justice in places like Hyannis and Brookline and those places where he racked up. And that's exactly where he should be talking about this stuff.
I'm going to have to wrap us there, but I am going to look forward to having the three of you in conversation again because that was fun and interesting. That was Marcela Garcia, an editorial writer for the Boston Globe. Thanks, Marcela.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Ferson, Democratic strategist, president of the Liberty Square Group and a paid consultant for Ed Markey's campaign. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
And WBUR's Anthony Brooks. Thanks for riding along today, Anthony.
Oh, my pleasure. It always is, Tiziana. Thank you.